What you're about to experience is one man's quest to see beyond the tumultuous period we're in and to envision what lies just beyond our grasp, yet well within our reach. Welcome to Larry Rifkin's America Trends, where the future has arrived, and it's just in time.
Welcome back to America Trends, Larry Rifkin and John Kropczyk. And, you know, we like to stretch those muscles, the brain muscle. We ask you to think about things that perhaps no other podcast really delves into. And on this one, John, well, let me ask you a question. Were you a wild teen, trouble for mom and dad, or no?
Yeah, I was.
You were?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah.
You got into a lot of mischief?
I did. I got into a lot of trouble in school and Oh, yeah.
I would never have imagined
that.
My
the hard part is my parents were both teachers, so everybody knew who I was. It was very difficult.
So what did you do?
Nothing really big, but I was just, you know, it just seemed like, I don't know whether trouble followed me or I followed trouble, but I was in the middle of stuff sometimes.
Okay. Well, that's not unusual. I mean, our teenage years are those years when we're trying to break away a little bit from mom and dad, but we haven't really figured it out. Our brains are still forming, and now we have learned that our brain development goes into our mid-20s. So it's not unusual that, you know, you find yourself really in some conflicted.
Rebelling.
Yeah.
The system.
But
yeah.
I mean, some do it in certain ways. I mean, I remember I wore the peace symbol on the top of my mortarboard, during, our high school graduation during the Vietnam War. And that was for me like a big protest.
Yeah, well, that was good.
But that wasn't crazy, John.
No, that wasn't really
crazy. No. I really was not that rebellious. I was very loud. I was, I would do things like, we'd had this substitute teacher and, they would call us in senior year for pictures, if you remember, for the yearbook.
Yeah.
And I would raise my hand for everything, you know, African American club. Hey, I gotta go. And she'd say, what? You know, I mean, just stupid little things
that.
But I didn't really like set fire in the boys' room.
I never was that bad.
No, yeah. No. How about smoking? Did you?
No, you know, I tried smoking a couple of times and it just didn't agree with me.
Yeah, but John, you're still smoking. Will you put yourself out, please?
That's the electronics over here.
Oh, that's the electronics. Okay. Well, according to some incredible research from Barbara Natterson Horowitz and Catherine Bowers, from high school seniors to humpback whales, these adolescents share a strikingly similar path to adulthood. Now, I've never thought about this.
No.
That it's something known to so many species. So it's not just the human teenager who has trouble figuring themselves out.
I wonder if those humpback whales have trouble opening those lockers. Like, they're always impossible to get open.
Yeah, that was something they brought out in the book, John. Yes. The epic journey from adolescence to adulthood in humans and other animals. Evidently, John. Now, I can't tell this because I can't really tell whether a humpback whale or a deer is 5 years old, 10, what that means in terms of their lifespan and whether they're teenagers, but they're moody at this stage of the teenage cycle. They push boundaries like you did.
Yeah.
They're socially awkward. Well, that's followed me all of my life, you know? No. And I wondered why that deer in my backyard was using my window as a mirror, John. You know, they're just primping because they have to appeal to the opposite sex, striking a pose like so many of our teens. But most similar is the fact that wild animal teens, they evidently take these outlandish risks, and we see a lot of teens involved in risky behaviors.
Yes.
So I thought this was really, really interesting as we try to figure out how close we resemble animals and how closely they resemble us. And this is incredible research that has been done by Barbara and Catherine. So why don't we delve into it, John? Because it really takes two women very expert in this area. And they've written another book called Zubiquity. And that was a New York Times bestseller. So you may know them from that previous work. But now they're on to Wildhood. And it really is fascinating. I think you're going to enjoy
it. Adolescence.
Absolutely.
Today.
Today on America Trends.
With me on the line on America Trends is Barbara Natterson Horowitz and Catherine Bowers. And they are the co-authors of the book Wildhood, The Epic Journey from Adolescence to Adulthood in Humans and Other Animals. And Barbara, explain to us why you thought this topic was so fascinating. I know the two of you were in California, maybe we can start there, and you began observing, as you always do, animal behavior, and it came upon you that this might be a great idea for a book.
Right. Well, Catherine and I have been working together for over 10 years, turning to the natural world for insights and even solutions to human health problems. I'm a physician and an evolutionary biologist, and Catherine is an animal behaviorist. And while we were researching our first book, which was about health, found ourselves, yes, along the coast of Northern California, and we were with a wildlife biologist to study the health of the California sea otter. So we were looking at this group of sea otter, and the biologist asked us to turn around and stare out at the ocean and told us that what we were looking at was called the Triangle of Death. And it is a 50-mile stretch of ocean that's called the Triangle of Death because it's so densely packed with great white sharks. In fact, almost 40% of all shark bites in the United States happen in this area. But the thing that was interesting to us was a comment he followed up with to say that the sea otters we were looking at were very careful. They really did not go into this dangerous shark-ridden area except for one group, and those were the adolescents. And that really caught our attention. And that's, in a sense, how this was launched.
So we're looking at teenagers, in a sense. I know that's what we call them. Catherine, is that the apt description, teenagers or adolescents? Because we're going to be using those probably interchangeably throughout our conversation.
Yes, adolescence is the right term for that time of life, and that's certainly the common term. Barbara and I actually, during our five-year study of this topic, realized that the term is not really good enough, though, to describe what happens at the once puberty begins and then a mature adult emerges. That's our definition of the period of time between childhood and adulthood, and we call that wildhood. It's the shared experience of adolescents and animals all over the world and through 600 million years of animal life on Earth, really. And during this time, they face the same four challenges. That is what our book is about.
Well, if somebody said, well, what's the value? In other words, oftentimes we're studying animals and other creatures to really understand better human behavior. What do you think is the greatest value? I mean, this book is remarkable, but what is it that you think we need to know about them to understand better about us?
Right. Well, I think that it's a good question. And the first part of an answer would be to talk about how dangerous and difficult human adolescence actually is. You know, we know that it's a very high-risk period for developing mental illness, lots of depression, lots of anxiety. We know that adolescents take risks and get into accidents. There are lots and lots of challenges for our species during this phase of life. And if you look at the sciences that have been applied to better understanding our teenagers and young adults as well, neurobiology has been useful, but we're really not making enough of an impact in some of these challenges. I mean, actually rates of depression and anxiety are rising. Mm-hmm. And so Catherine and I decided to apply a scientific methodology that we developed for our first project and apply it to animal adolescence. In other words, to look broadly across the animal kingdom from crustaceans, fish, amphibians, reptiles, birds, and other mammals to identify, if they were there, any patterns and trends which might give us insight into the kinds of problems that we've been challenged with in our own species and potentially solutions that would not be available if we weren't looking across the animal kingdom. So examples of the kinds of insights and solutions that we identified are in a number of areas. But one example would be risk-taking. Human adolescents take a lot of risks. They, you know, as a consequence, get into trouble. We know that the adolescent brain has been something we've talked about, that there are unique qualities of the adolescent brain that make adolescents take risks. But when you look across mammals, you see, and birds as well, you see, and fish included, you see that adolescents sometimes do something called predator inspection, which is actually a risky behavior. They approach rather than run away or swim away or fly away from their predators. You know, there's a lot of this more in the book, but the point is that by looking broadly at, you know, across the animal kingdom, we begin to have insights into why teenagers do the things they do, to understand why they're doing it and what the benefits may be. And through that path, we can potentially identify strategies and approaches that are more effective than the things we've been doing without this cross-species perspective.
Let me ask you about this key difference that someone listening might say, really? Because, I mean, you know, all of these species are so different. And at least help me understand this. If animals live really in the moment and respond to immediate stimuli or imminent danger, but then when we contrast that with us, with humans, where we envision a lot, we're often distracted, we're not living in the realm that we're in, we're dreaming about something else. I mean, does that make it really hard for us to draw some of these comparisons or no?
It's a wonderful question, and I think the response has to start with something that we've discovered over the last decade, which is there's a tremendous amount of sort of unexamined assumptions about the way wild animals are. And part of that is that we don't know that much about wild animals. I mean, we humans only know about a fraction of the, you know, 8.7 million other animal species. And one of the things, just to respond to the examples you gave, we know that many animals actually, based on their behavior, have some kind of, and I'm going to use the word knowledge in air quotes, of the future. There are animals that, you know, cache food, that is, they store foods. There are animals that create tools and then save the tools to be used in the future. Animals have the ability to have the marshmallow test, which, of course, we all are familiar with when little kids are given a marshmallow and asked to wait, and if they wait, they get a second marshmallow. Well, there are animals from, you know, birds and other mammals who the marshmallow test has been done on, and animals can delay and self-control. There are animals that, animal parents that actually, based on the adverse experiences of their youngsters when they're young, can modify the way they parent. So I think as we learn more and more about the range and capacity and flexibility and diversity of animal behavior, it becomes harder and harder to be worried about, you know, anthropomorphizing and, you know, assuming that our species is so unique.
Yeah, we had a strong concern not to attribute human characteristics unscientifically to other animals, as Barbara said, anthropomorphizing problem. So we are very careful not to do that. And our conclusion is that the bigger problem isn't anthropomorphism, but rather human exceptionalism, and thinking that our behavior is so vastly different from that of the other creatures that we share the earth with.
Before I get into some of the four core challenges that you discuss in the book, help me understand one thing, because I've been reading a lot about adolescents today and their clock, and the fact that I know a lot of high schools are trying to adjust their clock to more respond to the way that these young people are maturing. And they're not necessarily up at the crack of dawn and their best in the early morning. Do you see anything across species that suggests that that's a commonality?
Right. We wondered the same thing. Sleep's been really an interesting topic. One of the comments I would make is that we know increasingly that our human brains and bodies are very much entrained with the light and dark cycles, with, you know, the circadian rhythms. And this is true, of course, in animals as well. And there are developmental phases of life where that may be more pronounced than others. And what we do know for certain is that sleep is an important part of animal life, and that depending on where an animal is on the social hierarchy, they may get better or worse sleep. And since adolescents are often subordinates in these groups, there's a question about whether adolescents are in fact getting enough or good sleep.
There's also a term that we came across when we were looking at the process of dispersal, when animals leave their native home to kind of strike out on their own in the world, and that's called Zugenruhe, and it basically means migration anxiety. And it's seen in birds and mammals when they're about to leave home, and it tends to be accompanied by sleeplessness and a sort of agitated behavior. So there may be some sort of like systemic developmental phase-wide Zugenruhe happening to teens as well.
You do point out in the book that mood swings, angst, raging hormones are not uniquely human in any way, that these adolescents across species really do exhibit these traits.
Right. I mean, it's not one for one. We certainly would never say that, you know, non-human animal adolescents are exactly like human adolescents. Absolutely not. Human beings, of course, have many unique characteristics, as does every species. However, there are some many, many overlooked commonalities. And just to pull one of the examples that you offered, the idea that there are mood swings in non-human animals. So first of all, do animals even have moods would be question number one. And obviously we can't ask an animal what their mood is. It would require a human language, which, you know, animals don't have human language. They have their own languages very often. But what we can observe is that among animals living in groups, every animal, for example, fish living in a school, every single fish has a relationship with every other fish. You know, they're different. They're not clones. And one part of that relationship is that one is higher or lower on the status hierarchy. Yes, fish have status. And it turns out when two fish come together and they have some kind of a contest and one wins and one loses, each one's brain chemistry changes. And those changes affect their behavior. For example, fish that lose and lose and lose end up over time exhibiting, you know, less movement, less motion. They don't initiate activity. They may be withdrawn. And although I can't ask that fish what they feel like, what their mood is, that behavior is very similar to what we see in severely depressed human adolescents. Our research, and we did this project over quite a long period of time, and we had an opportunity to look at the way the brains of crustaceans, so we're talking about lobsters and crayfish, fish like rainbow trout and salmon, reptiles like lizards, birds, and mammals, how they respond to rising in status and falling in status, what we call the biology of comparison. And how that works is very similar to how it works in our species and really underlies not only mood swings in adolescents, but we think why social media today is causing an uptick in anxiety and depression among teens.
What about self-harm? I mean, we are seeing a rise in suicide rates in human teens. How is there any correlation there?
Well, you know, there are two separate pieces to this, and obviously it's a very serious subject, and there's not a simple answer.
Of course.
I would say what can animals teach us about self-harm and potentially even suicidality in humans? To address self-harm, you know, we've studied, actually, Catherine and I have studied self-injury in non-human animals quite extensively, and self-injury is not uncommon at all. It's seen in, you know, in fish, reptiles, birds, and other mammals. Self-injury in humans is anything from, you know, hair plucking disorder to the more serious self-injury that's sometimes called cutting. And that's very different from suicidality. In fact, that is actually definitely not suicidality. It is really hard to, you know, people ask us often, do animals commit suicide? And we would say, you know, the kind of suicide that most parents, for example, are concerned about in adolescence is related to severe depression. And there's no evidence that non-human animals commit suicide, you know, in that way. But what we can say is that the brain biology of a young animal who is constantly being sorted to the bottom of groups is very similar to the brain biology of severe human adolescents. And we think that is a very important clue and can help us.
And in our study of self-injury, we wrote about what a veterinarian looks for when they're looking at animals that are injuring themselves. And there's three factors that consistently dial up that behavior in animals, and that's stress, isolation, and boredom. So if a parent or a teen is sort of facing those issues, looking for stress, isolation, and boredom are probably good places to start.
Wildhood is the book, The Epic Journey from Adolescence to Adulthood in Humans and Other Animals. Barbara Natterson Horowitz is with us, along with Catherine Bowers. Peer influence is so important among American adolescents and other adolescents around the world. What would you say about peer influence in all of this as it relates to the whole animal kingdom?
So remember that our goal always was to see whether we could have developed insights and even solutions that we, by looking across the animal kingdom, to challenges that we were facing in human teens. And peer pressure, yes, for sure. We know that peers can be both negative and positive. On the negative side, being with other teenagers, for example, lowers the threshold for risk-taking. And what that means is that when there are other teens around, it's more likely that teenagers will do things that are risky that they might not do if they were by themselves. So that would probably be a negative. Our research suggests that there may be some very important evolutionary reasons for that related to predator inspection, what we talked about before. But the flip side is that peers are extraordinarily important for animals, for young animals, for young fish and for young birds and young mammals. For example, adolescent fish have to be with other adolescent fish in order to learn to school properly. They need to be with other adolescents to learn birdsong properly. It turns out without peers, animals can't really learn to effectively learn live in groups.
And actually, a lot of adolescent animals head out into the world together, like penguins go off in groups, and sharks tend to form these groups of adolescents and bachelor herds and mixed-sex herds of, horses and zebras are kind of out there together, figuring the world out together, both because there's safety in numbers, but also, as Barbara said, there's really important lessons that they can only learn when they're with each other. And when they're isolated, they don't learn those lessons of safety and social hierarchy and living on their own.
Wild animals do get human diseases. I find some of the things in your book fascinating that I didn't know. And they do have insomnia. They do have anxiety. We kind of got into that earlier. But I never realized that they got all the human diseases as well. Was that at all surprising, or is that something scientists have known forever?
Yeah, so I'm a physician by training, and I spent 20 years as a professor of medicine at UCLA. I'm a cardiologist, and I was actually one day called to the LA Zoo to help with some of their animal patients, and at that point was really exposed to the world of veterinary medicine for the first time. And Catherine and I started talking about this issue and really spent the next several years deeply exploring not only how overlapping the diseases of animals and humans are, and we're talking about everything from heart attacks, atrial fibrillation, high cholesterol to, breast cancer, brain tumors, and even anxiety disorder and depression and all these kinds of things. But it was not only that there's such an overlap, but it was remarkable that human and veterinary medicine were so separated. And we came to the conclusion in our first book, Zubiquity, that human exceptionalism, again, this idea that, we are uniquely unique as a species, that human exceptionalism was acting as a kind of blindfold that was making it difficult for the field of human medicine to benefit from all the insight from veterinary medicine. And that was the focus of our work for about 5 years.
You do say in the book that all animals and humans on the journey to adulthood face four core challenges. So however you'd like to stack them, one is how to stay safe, the other to negotiate status, next, dealing with sexuality. As we know, our teens and adolescents are certainly always navigating that, and cultivating self-reliance. How would you like to dig into these? Because this is so central to what it is you're talking about in Wildhood.
I'll just start off and then I'll pass it to Catherine. But, we actually came to the conclusion, and by the way, we identified these four competencies by this methodology that we developed to look, broadly across species and comprehensively at the animal literature to identify patterns and trends. But I'm just going to kick it off by saying that in a sense, the destiny of every adolescent on planet Earth, regardless of what species she or he may be, the destinies can be really predicted and, in a sense, understood by whether or not these competencies, these skills, are mastered or not. So, for example, the first of these competencies is safety, right? A young animal has to learn to recognize predators and exploiters and know what to do about it. We know that that adolescent animals who are big enough, just big enough to be outside of direct parental protection, but who lack experience, are in a lot of danger. They are literally easy prey and targeted by both predators in the animal world and exploiters in the human world. So that's the first skill that is so crucial. And by the way, remaining predator naive is a very dangerous state. Gaining knowledge about danger is actually one of the core competencies of adolescence. And the second issue is really learning how to live with others and understand social hierarchies and learning social competency, you know, how to make friends, how to build coalitions, how to respond properly. And failing to acquire that competency in the animal world can mean being sorted to the bottom of groups, which can be a very dangerous situation. And in our species, it can lead to all kinds of challenges, including, we think, depression and anxiety. The third competency is communicating your sexuality. And that is something which was really fascinating for us to learn about because, you know, in human sex ed very often is a lot about pregnancy prevention and preventing sexually transmitted infections. But in fact, our students, and Catherine and I teach a course at Harvard called Coming of Age on Planet Earth, and we teach the material that's in Wildhood to these 18 to 22-year-old undergraduates. And they tell us when it comes to sex that, yes, from the time they were in, you know, elementary or middle school, they were learning about, you know, pregnancy prevention and all that. But what they really want to learn about is romance and sexual communication. And what we learned from studying wild animal sexuality and adolescent sexuality is that wild animals go through puberty. That is, their bodies start, you know, making spermatozoa or ovulating. So they're biologically capable of making offspring. But very often there is a delay between that moment and when they actually start mating. And the reasons for that are fascinating and complex. And but the point is that it's not just, you know, ready body equals sex. And a big part of what animals are doing is they're learning courtship, that bidirectional, two-way conversation that animals have with each other, which is essentially, are we or aren't we? Should we or shouldn't we? And there are many, many steps to it. And even among, you know, insects, you know, there's a back and forth and a back and forth, and both the female and the male fly. Their brains have different centers that signal yes or no, yes or no. And so that's the third core competency and can take a long time. And the final competency, of course, is learning to take care of yourself on your own, being self-reliant, finding food, finding a place to live. This self-reliance that is so crucial for independence and isn't an automatic ability. It needs to be learned like everything else.
Yeah, well, we were really surprised to learn how much practice to leave home many animals get before they actually have to go make it on their own. Whether it's practice dispersals that possums go through when their moms take them out into the woods and have them choose a place to spend the night and a day foraging for food and making their own nest, and then they come back the next day before they actually go disperse on their own. They're called practice dispersals. Or whether it's the extended parental care that some penguins give their fledglings, that, you know, they one day go off and swim off into the ocean, but if it's a dangerous environment that they've gone into, a lot of predators and not very much food, often they will return to their parent and be fed again. Not unlike human boomerang parents, boomerang children who get such a bad reputation for returning home after they've left. That's actually a lot more natural than you might think.
The animal in the basement, so to speak. Let me ask you about the period that we're talking about, because among humans, we have now extended the age of adolescence in terms of criminal responsibility and the like. We've changed our thinking a lot about that. How about in the animal kingdom, in terms of the length of time, because obviously their maturation can be much quicker because their lifespan may be much shorter than ours?
Yes, well, one of our early goals with this project was to offer some clarity to the very confusing question, what is adolescence? So as you aptly just pointed out, you know, the legal definition of sort of responsibility is one thing. You know, the American Academy of Pediatrics has one definition of adolescence in terms of when it ends, which is different from the World Health Organization. You know, you can join the military at 18. You can't vote. You can vote at 18. You can't buy cigarettes until you're 21. I mean, there's just all of these, this range of what the heck are we talking about with adolescence? And by the way, you know, the neurobiologists believe that adolescence continues into the mid to late 20s as the brain continues to develop. So we found this to be just a big mess, and we actually also really thought that, you know, as you pointed out, you know, as society changes and modern human life exerts different challenges, that perhaps it's time to not talk about adolescence as some number, some chronological number, or not link it to some biological characteristic, but rather talk about competencies, skills. What is it that makes a mature adult? And as soon as we adopted that frame, we noted something really important and powerful. If you look at the beginning of our book, we have a chart that shows the four competencies, and we show a wide range of animals and how long it takes for them, more or less, to pass through wildhood. And you'll notice that all of the wild animals, there's a discrete end. And what that means is if young animals have not developed competency in all four of these areas, they're probably not going to survive, frankly. But of course, in our modern species, that's not the case. And I think all of us know someone in our lives who is chronologically an adult, that is you know, certainly through their 20s, maybe even in their 30s or beyond, and are not very mature. I mean, if you look at the four competencies, you could probably say, yeah, they don't have this or they don't know how to do that. So we really think this competency-based, skill-based redefinition of this period of life is more helpful. It's more helpful not only for parents and teachers, but also for young people themselves in terms of what should I be doing with my time? What are the skills that I need to know? What makes a mature adult?
Let me ask this question. Now, this may seem out of left field, but the teenage brain or the adolescent brain is different from other age groups. But we have deep and enduring memories formed during this period, you tell us and others. And humans, we do various things. We'll hold a reunion because we want to hold on to what those memories meant to us. We'll listen to music that goes back to that era. Is there anything comparable? How do animals store the important information or that which really gave them such pleasure and really endures into their adulthood?
Yes, there is this particularly sensitive aspect of the human adolescent brain that we seem to remember things. The lessons that we learn, let's say, are kept more deeply. We can remember song lyrics, right, from our adolescence better than we can, you know, from a year ago. And I'll pass this to Catherine in just a second, but it just so happens that one of my big high school reunions was last weekend, and I was in touch with a few of my friends in the weeks leading up to it, saying, "Hey, are you guys going to go?" And you know, some wanted to go, and others were like, "Ah, kind of makes me nervous. I don't think so." And we were sort of talking about it, and I think one of the reasons that a couple of my friends didn't want to go was, you know, they didn't feel so great in high school, and some of those people, you know, they might have been bullied by them, they might have felt like they were kind of subordinates to them, and going back might activate those feelings, even though they've changed substantially in the decades that have followed. But I thought that was pretty interesting and reminded me of one of the animal studies that Catherine and I reviewed, which looked at rainbow trout, looked at a big dominant older rainbow trout and a younger, probably adolescent subordinate. And, of course, the subordinate behaves like a subordinate, you know, kind of deferring and doing all the things that subordinate rainbow trouts do when they're in the company of dominant rainbow trout. But in this experiment, the investigators took the subordinate out of the tank, put him in another tank, and gave him a lot of food so that the subordinate grew bigger and bigger and ultimately bigger than the dominant. They then put the now larger, formerly subordinate rainbow trout back in the original tank. And one would expect, because the fish is bigger, that he would assume dominance. But in fact, that rainbow trout reverted to the subordinate behavior. So thought that was sort of interesting in the context of being nervous about a high school reunion.
Catherine, anything you want to add?
Yeah, I would just say that, yes, it's a very sensitive time of life, and that, you know, the brain helps us remember these sort of the good and the bad in a much stronger way. But it is really important to have these social experiences at that age, because just in species after species, Barbara and I found that the animals that were isolated during adolescence just don't learn the socializing and even the sort of sexual communication that they need to know to be happy adults. So as hard as it might seem, as long as an individual isn't being sorted to the bottom of every single group that they're in, the being social is usually more important than not being social. And in fact, that's something that we can do as human beings, is we can practice being in lots of different groups. Many animals are sort of stuck in their one group, but as humans, we can choose, and it's good to have that practice.
Is there any piece of advice that you could give to parents listening to this podcast who are having a difficult time with this phase of growth based upon behaviors across the animal kingdom? Is there anything that you would offer as a suggestion to help them understand what it is that the adolescent is going through?
Yes, let me just jump in. And I think I'd start by echoing what Catherine was just saying about the importance of these experiences. You know, the two pieces of advice would be, or kind of insights, would be what we've learned from wild animal adolescence is that it is a difficult phase of life, that is normal and natural, because these lessons are really important, and they're not learned automatically. They're learned through sometimes very challenging experiences. However, you know, obviously, I mean, one of the things we learned in studying how young fish become safer from predators, you know, one of the most powerful safety experiences a young fish can have is to have a brush with death. But of course, that is a very, very high stakes way of gaining safety information. What we all want our kids to have is you know, the experience, the knowledge associated with the brush with death, but God forbid, not the death itself. So I'm a parent of, my kids are now in their 20s, but in terms of the worrying and the concern, I think the more information that we have about what teenagers need to learn, what they should be doing with their time, what might be important and what might be less important in terms of ultimately helping them be safer and happier and more connected and more self-sufficient and independent, that looking across species is actually a source of insights that are really not available to us if we're only looking at Homo sapiens.
And we really do feel that wildhood opens doors to these important conversations that you really need to have, starting with, you know, adolescents as young as third grade, just starting out up to about age 30, and on either side of that it really matters how a person learns to feel safe, how they learn to fit in and find groups of other people. We're social animals. It's very important how they express sexuality and express desire and treat the desire of others, and then also how they go on to live adult lives and form their own communities. That these four things are so important that the conversations really need to start early about all four of them.
Well, with two young people in my family over 30, I don't think it even stops at 30. Well, whatever. Barbara Natterson-Horowitz and Catherine Bowers, fascinating, really. Wildhood, the epic journey from adolescence to adulthood in humans and other animals. Thank you so much for being a part of America Trends.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure talking to you. Thanks so much.
America Trends podcast is part of the MHNR Network. MHNRnetwork.com.